Hello, everyone, and welcome to Season 3 of Inside LBUSD, the Laguna Beach Unified School District podcast. It's been a couple of months since we released our last episode, but we're really excited to kick this season off with a bang. Our first episode of Season 3 features an incredible conversation between our Director of Social-Emotional Support, Dr. Michael Keller, and world-renowned therapist, author, and speaker, Lynn Lyons, about how families, students, and educators can manage anxiety. For over 30 years, Ms. Lyons has developed and taught strategies and skills that are concrete, immediately usable, and that go after the patterns that keep anxiety in charge of families, sometimes for generations. Her clinical practice is rooted firmly in the belief that such strategies can be taught to anyone looking to overcome anxiety and manage the challenges of daily life. I think you guys are really going to love this conversation. And now, Health Matters with Dr. Michael Keller and Lynn Lyons.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Health Matters Podcast. This is Michael Keller, and I'm here with a very special guest, Lynn Lyons. Lynn, hello.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
We had such an amazing day with you yesterday. You provided our staff members, leadership teams, student support specialists, our school psychologists, school counselors, an incredible session. You then worked with our teachers, and then we had a wonderful family session and some really awesome students that joined us.
We did. I was delighted to see how many kids showed up, and then they were so willing to ask questions at the end. So it was really nice.
You were amazing, and we learned so much from your incredible talks yesterday. I do have some questions for you today, and just wanted to learn a little bit more about your work with young people and families. And you are an expert in anxiety. What does it mean to be an expert in anxiety treatment?
Well, probably it just means that you've been hanging around for a long time. And I think it's just that you specialize in it. So I think, you know, I don't love the word expert because I know there's always things that I'm learning. I guess the way I would define expert is that I remain very curious and interested about how this thing shows up and what it does. I try and pay attention to the research. And I really feel like treating anxiety is about being creative as often as possible, because anxiety can be really boring and mundane and you say the same things over and over again. So my job is to really be in the business of making it interesting for kids to learn about it and figure out what to do about it.
Well, we heard some really cool feedback last night. One student in particular said, "How are your jokes so funny?" Which I thought was a great compliment.
Yeah, that was the best question I've ever gotten at a presentation. When a kid raises his hand and says, you know, like, "You were funny," I'm like, all right,
yeah,
I'm doing my
it.
Job. Yeah, so important. Anxiety hates a sense of humor. Long, long ago, actually, somebody gave me feedback on one of those forums after a presentation that said that they did not like the fact that I was using humor because anxiety is a very serious problem and that we shouldn't joke about it. And I was like, oh, dude.
Yeah, well, that's missing a lot of the point.
Exactly. So,
yesterday, we gave copies of Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents to our families. You've written several books. And that book in particular has really been helpful and for us to think about how we can go about reframing and thinking about anxiety as a condition in young people. Yesterday, you spoke about, are we doing the disorder? What mm-hmm. exactly do you mean by that?
So anxiety, I talk about anxiety as a cult leader. It's got certain requirements. And so if you are trying to help somebody with anxiety, you've got to be really sure that you're not actually helping the anxiety. And a lot of times we do the things that feel good in the moment. We do the things that work in the moment for sure. But those are the things that support the anxiety disorder itself. And that means, and they're really counterintuitive, and I totally get that you're just trying to help your kid, but it means that you're trying to create an environment in which there's a lot of certainty, in which the goal is to make sure that your child is comfortable all the time, that you work really hard to avoid any triggers so that they don't get upset, and that you really demand, not in a bossy way, sometimes in a bossy way, but you really demand and require that the external world make sure that your child doesn't feel anxious. All of that increases the strength of the disorder.
Yeah, and you talk a lot about how that actually makes the world of the person experiencing anxiety or the family that's dealing with anxiety smaller.
Right, because you have to start avoiding things. So if your child is afraid of dogs, then you want to make sure that they only go at play dates to play dates at houses where there aren't dogs, or if they're at a birthday party and they're afraid of this. And think about, anxiety will grab on to whatever it can grab on to. So if you have a child who's afraid of getting sick, if you have a child who's afraid of embarrassing him or herself, if you have a child who's worried about death, man, it starts making the experiences that one can have more and more limited. It just wants to shut things down. I say all the time to parents, anxiety does not care at all if your kid tries out for the school play or learns how to play the clarinet or goes to sleepaway camp or gets their driver's license or gets a job or falls in love. Anxiety is not interested in your child's growth and exploration at all. And that's what we have to pay attention to.
Oh, it's really interesting and insightful. So you also talk about the importance of really thinking about this as a systemic problem mm-hmm. with a child. And mm-hmm. so, and you approach your treatment with young people as in a family setting. So why is it so important to think about anxiety treatment as a systemic problem?
Well, because we know that it's really socially driven, and the same as depression, right? We are social creatures. And so when all of the things that we do when we raise our kids, all the values we instill in them or the celebrations or the rituals we have as families or the things that we hold important, we love all that stuff. Well, the negative stuff comes too. So if you are a yeller, you might have a kid that's a yeller, right? You can't say to your kids, don't hit your brother, smack, right? So when it comes to anxiety, We are very clear, and the research is very clear, that there are patterns that are passed down. And it's modeling is really a powerful thing. And sometimes people are like, oh, you're blaming me. No, I'm just talking about the way that social beings work. And modeling can be both positive and negative. So we really want to pay attention to what we're modeling for our kids in terms of how they step into the world, how we manage risk, how we talk about uncertainty. So it truly, I said this last night, it makes no sense to me, and it has never made any sense to me, why you would treat a child alone and not have the parents a part of the process. And I mean really a part of the process, not like a little 5-minute check-in, but really a part of the process, because that's how families work.
Yeah, that really sounds like that helps not only with the kind of the homework assignments you mm-hmm. might be giving to families, but all the work outside of the therapy session mm-hmm. really does help them generalize those skills in a variety of different opportunities.
Yeah. I say all the time, if you made me choose, except if you're teenagery, right, then we start wanting to support independence and separation. But with kids up to the age of probably 13 or 14 at least, if you said to me, you have to choose, Lynn, you can only see the child or the parents, you got to pick one. 95% of the time, if you make me choose, I'm going to choose the parents, because they are the consultants, they are the coaches, they are leading this family, and they deserve that information. Parents will say to me, when somebody comes to me, and maybe they've been seeing somebody else or they're coming for a consult, and I say, well, what brings you to me? Like, what do you want from me? They will inevitably say some version of, just tell me what to do, mm-hmm. right? I just need instruction. I just need to know. Give me the words. Give me a script. Give me a plan. And as a mental health professional, it is really, really important that we listen to what people want and we give them concrete stuff to work with.
Yeah, that's really helpful to be working with the family system on solving these really complicated issues with students. Or children, excuse me. And so when we think about the school context, teachers often see up 20 to 30 students in a classroom for elementary. They can see upwards of 140, 150 students for secondary. What are some of the early signs that a student or a child might be exhibiting or experiencing anxiety?
So the earliest signs you see are going to be around separation anxiety. So that's what we see. Although the diagnostic labels don't really mean all that much to me, but it does put it in context. So when you have kids that you're seeing, they're having a really hard time being away from parents, and it doesn't go away. So it lasts the whole day. So there's a lot of emotional distress. they can't focus on their work. You don't see them engaging with peers. So one of the things to remember about anxiety in general is that it's referred to as an internalizing disorder. So when you see kids that are really focused internally, that they're really not engaging, you don't see them having fun, you don't see them being curious, that's something to pay attention to. The other thing I think that parents and teachers miss often is that kids that are seeking certainty. So when you have kids that are asking questions all the time, repeated questions, they need to know, need to know, need to know, need to know, that's seeking reassurance, and that's a red flag that teachers should pay attention to. So if a kid says, hey, what pages do I need to read for this assignment? And the teacher says, page 20 to 24. They go, okay. And then 2 minutes later, they say, what were those pages? And can you go over it with me again? They just can't close the certainty loop, we say. So that's something to pay attention to. And then also we really want to look at rigidity. So the need to have things a certain way, and a lot of distress when things happen, when the schedule changes, when the teacher is absent. I had a long time ago, I had a school had in place a plan that if the fourth grade teacher was going to be absent, the school secretary would call the parents so then the fourth grader could decide whether or not he was going to come to school. And so when we see that inability to go with the flow, for lack of a better phrase, to manage, to be able to work through changes, that's a really, really big red flag.
Wow, that's really helpful. And then from there, you know, you mentioned a variety of different traps that families or school, well-intentioned school professionals would fall into to mm-hmm. help try to address or alleviate some of those symptoms. Maybe that's the problem, is the attempt to alleviate those mm-hmm. issues.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about stepping into the issue as a treatment philosophy or treatment approach. Can you explain a little bit more about those traps that well-intentioned family members or school staff should try to avoid?
So these would be called elimination strategies. And elimination strategies are whenever we're trying to offer a child a way to get out of their feelings or to move out of a situation. So we're saying to them either directly or implicitly, you can't feel this way, or we're going to help you not feel this way. These feelings are too big for you to handle. So then we teach them things, or we do things that help them avoid or get out of a situation. So some of the more common ones are putting in accommodations where a child doesn't have to do a certain thing so they can skip this class, or a lot of times they're not going to walk in the halls when other students are in the halls, or they are not going to have this particular teacher. I've heard that a lot of times. Or we're not going to give them assignments or give them things that will make them feel any distress. So we put those into plans where, for example, a child doesn't have to take a test in a certain room, or they get extended deadlines because they can't get their work done because they're so anxious about it. All of that stuff that people do absolutely comes from the right place. But the goal is, what you're saying to a child is, we want to make sure that you can be in school and you can do these things and you can feel comfortable while you're here. Fabulous. But we're going to do that first. We're going to check in with the anxiety and make sure that everything we're doing is okay with the anxiety disorder. And what we really want to do is we want to give kids the opportunity to step into these things, because that's how they learn that they can handle it. That's how they learn that they can manage perhaps more than they thought that they could manage. So when adults are giving kids the message that the kids are fragile, that they can't handle these feelings, that there's a problem, kids listen to that, and then they live up to those expectations, unfortunately. And I'm hearing that a lot these days, and that's language we really need to pay attention to.
Yeah, that's really important to be thinking about all the different ways that we might reinforce or inadvertently literally continue the impairment or those symptoms that students might be experiencing, even when we're well-intentioned to try to, well, remove mm-hmm. those, what they perceive as to be obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, you shared a really important idea that perhaps anxious parents, or, and I'm going to say, people in the student's or child's environment, talk too much. How does over-talking play a role in anxiety maintenance, and how might we improve?
Well, so yeah, so that's one of my stock phrases is talk 85% less, which my family points out to me all the time is rather ironic because I talk for a living. But the problem is that we want to keep talking at kids when they're feeling distressed. We want to keep giving them more information. We want to keep giving them reassurance. We think that the way we make them feel less anxious is to just go over things over and over and over and over and over again. And actually, the opposite is true. We want to provide support and empathy and love and all that encouragement, but then we want to give the student, we want to give the child the opportunity to work through some things, to observe. I always want to make somebody a curious observer of themselves and their environment. And when we are talking and talking and talking, we're not giving any room for that person to just be able to do what they need to do on the inside in order to move forward. So oftentimes we just need to be quiet. So we offer that support. I know this is tough for you. I know it. You can handle it. I'm here to support you. I'm really proud of the efforts that you're making. Boom. Be quiet. You don't then have to say, and just remember that when the teacher comes in, blah, 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 for one, they're not listening to you. And as kids get older, they actually get more and more annoyed by the fact that the parents are talking so much, and they will become less willing to share things with parents. One of the things that it's really important for parents to know is that your reaction often dictates not only how a child perceives a situation, just like the little kid that falls and scrapes their knee, right? If the parent goes, oh, look at that, or the parent goes, oh my God. So how they perceive a situation, but then how willing they are to share what is going on inside of them. They don't want to hear a diatribe. And so if a child is having difficulty with something and they come home from school and say, oh, I was so nervous about this. And if a parent launches in, they're going to be like, oh, next time I'm just going to not bring it up. We want kids to bring it up. And then here's a little tip. Start asking how questions as a parent. So instead of saying, well, why did that happen? Or why did you do that? Or why do you think your teacher said that? You start saying, well, how do you think you could manage your feelings? Or how can you solve this problem? How questions result in action, and why questions often result in just more analysis, and that's really doing the disorder. Because if there's any disorder that wants to overanalyze, it's anxiety.
Absolutely, that's so helpful. So I love that you just kind of drop that period of just observing what happened, the happening, mm-hmm. and then give the space, just be quiet, just listen.
Just be quiet, yeah.
Give this child some space to process, mm-hmm. and make their own judgments about the situation.
Exactly.
You talk a lot about depersonalization and really pulling the anxiety out and giving it a name. And can you talk a little bit more about that strategy and how that might be used in both the home or the school setting to support processing those hard feelings?
The reason that externalization is so helpful, right, pulling out the worry part, is because it creates this distance between you and your thoughts and your feelings. And so when we give kids the message that, you know, you can think things and you can feel things and you can have these sensations, it's okay. And now we can step back and we can talk about them and we can understand them and we can expect them. So the three X's that I often give is that we're going to expect the worry to show up, right? And we've given it a name. We've called it Joanne or Pete or whatever. We're going to expect it to show up. Why? Because it's normal to have those thoughts. We're going to externalize it. We're going to be an observer of it. These things are so predictable and redundant. And then the third X is that we're going to experiment. So we're going to step in and we're going to do things on purpose so we can see, can we get Pete to show up? Why do we want Pete to show up? So we can learn about how Pete operates. So the more that it sort of goes back to that elimination you were talking about, the more that we say, oh, we can't feel these things or we can't experience these things, the more that kids learn that avoidance is what we're supposed to do. So when we externalize it, right, there it is, notice it, no big deal. I want kids to be bored with their worry instead of treat it like it's an emergency. So I want when worry shows up, you know, they name it, you know, whatever they name it, Sally. I want them to be like, Oh, hi, Sally. Yeah, I knew you were going to show up because we're going to go in the car and you always show up. I just want them to have a different relationship with it. And when it's out there, and then parents can talk about the worry in a way that they can sort of unload their frustration about it. And it protects a child's dignity. So Sally shows up. And the mother can say, like, oh, my God, Sally, you are so annoying. Why are you bossing around Sophia so much? And then that way they can be sort of together. And we have the worry over there. And then the child and the parent are sort of on the same team.
Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. That's an awesome joining strategy. And, yeah, in the mindfulness space, I think they mm-hmm. call it bringing it up and out.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's the same thing. That's why mindfulness is so helpful. Because, you know, if you listen to anybody, if you listen to trauma experts, if you listen to people who focus on depression, if you listen to people focusing on OCD, on anxiety, one of the very effective strategies across the board is creating distance between you and your thoughts and your feelings.
That's great. Well, I know that over your incredible career serving individuals and families, that you have had some pretty dramatic success stories that maybe initially you thought were going to be really challenging and entrenched mm-hmm. cases. Is there anything in particular that you could share about maybe a particular case without sharing too much information, but maybe something that you thought was really daunting and how you overcame and had a success with one of your families?
Yeah. There's been plenty of those. I think that one of the things that sort of makes me laugh now when I think about it is these families come in, and of course they're exhausted, they're stressed out, the parents are really worried about their child, the child probably doesn't even want to be there. And so I do my thing. One of the things about the way I practice is I get started really quickly, right? They want information. I'm going to give them things. And so I'll have a kid come in, and as soon as it becomes clear that I'm not going to abide by the cult leader, as soon as I start to say to the parent, okay, so I get that you've been trying to figure out how to give the anxiety what it wants. We're going to go in a different direction, however I say that. The eyebrows of the child go up, and I can tell, like, they are not going to be happy with this. They start whispering in their parents' ear. They start saying things like, you know, get me out of here, and I hate this lady. I had one case where a girl came to see me. She had seen a lot of therapists in the past, and she was a tough nut, right? She was just not playing. And there were a lot of issues that she was worried about because content doesn't matter to me. But the thing that she wanted to work on was that she was afraid of dogs and she really wanted a dog. So I met with the parents first and I knew this. So I told her, you're here to get over your worry about dogs. And I left all the other content over there. And the dad said to her, if you will work on this with Lynn and you will get over your worry about dogs, we will get a dog. I promise you, we will get a dog. Now, she left that session. I thought it went great. She left that session, and her mom told me on the way out of the office, she looked at her mom and said, I hate that lady. Well, they came back anyway. We worked on it. My job was, I really had to figure out how to talk to this girl about worry in a way that kept her engaged. And they ended up with a dog named Beatrice. much to the dad's surprise. And what was nice is that I worked with that family and they were delightful. And then about a year ago now, this young girl was, I think, a junior in high school, and some other things were coming up and she was having difficulty. And she was so eager to come back and talk to me about what she needed to work through, because we had established that
That's
relationship.
Great.
And that happens a lot. I'll see kids when they're younger and then they show back up. But I think probably the reason I like that case is because, one, she was such a tough nut and I really had to work hard. But also I think I changed her impression of what therapy could help with.
Yeah.
And I gave her an experience that said to her, I can work through things and I can reach my goals, which is not how she came into my office.
That's outstanding. That's great. That's encouraging for anybody that's out there kind of thinking that some of these situations might be kind of hopeless and enduring. You talked a lot about that yesterday. You talked about how that sometimes the symptoms of anxiety really become a more permanent identity feature. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss what you're seeing and then how you might approach kind of reframing that or changing that thinking?
Yeah, so what I'm seeing is that teenagers in particular, teenagers and young adults, have really embraced this idea. I mean, we've done a lot to try and increase mental health awareness and talk about it, but the unfortunate flip side of that is that in all this language that we've given them, and they've become very conversant in diagnosis and all that kind of stuff. One, they're very quick to diagnose themselves. They're doing it on social media like crazy. Khloe Kardashian is really not the best person to learn about OCD from. That just my personal opinion. But they have taken it on as who they are, and in that rigidity, in that permanence, they are learning, or they are embracing this idea that's the exact opposite of what we need kids to hear, both about their brains and about their relationships and about their growth, and certainly about anxiety and depression. Anxiety and depression are really treatable. We can learn a lot about ourselves. There are very few human beings on the planet that will get through life without having some episode of anxiety or a bout of depression. And if we're telling kids when they're 13, 14, 15 that this is who they are forevermore, that is exactly the opposite message. Mm-hmm. And as we're concerned about kids with suicide and self-harm and substances, if you are saying to a kid, this is who you are, there's really nothing you can do about it, and the world is going to have to accommodate you, why in the world are they going to do the hard work of figuring out who they are and going to therapy or learning about themselves if the message is, look, this is it, this is who you are? And we don't do that with other things. And I just really think it's so, so incredibly damaging to do it with mental health. And yet I'm hearing it all the time now.
Yeah, I think that's such an important message, and it goes back to that really that intense focus on flexibility versus being rigid or living in a world of chaos. So that's really helpful.
Yeah.
So as we're getting towards the end of our time, I'm just curious about, from your own professional development and professional arc, who are some of your greatest teachers professionally?
Michael Yapko is somebody who I met when I was 26. And when you hear me talk about how questions and the need to differentiate between this and that, all of that comes from him. He was incredibly concrete. When I met him when I was 26, it was like he was speaking this language that just made sense to me. So he's present in all my writings. My last book was dedicated to him. And if I can just give parents a really great resource, actually a free resource, if you go to his website, yapko.com, it's Y-A-P-K-O. He has a talk on depression that he gave a few years ago that now has over 5 million views on YouTube. So if you have a teenager or you're looking for a good solid discussion about it, I highly recommend watching that. I think it's like about, you know, maybe 48 minutes or something, but that's a great resource. Reed Wilson, who I wrote two of my books with, I met him. He just came up and introduced himself to me when I was presenting at my first national conference, actually. And he has been incredibly impactful in my learning, and has just become a great and treasured friend. I would say those are the two people that are the most influential. There are a few other women professionals, therapists. One is a couples therapist, who have just been great mentors for me in this field. Because part of being a therapist, and I want young people to hear this, I run a business too. Mm-hmm. And therapists, we don't really get trained in running a business. So I've had great mentors in that regard as well.
And do you want to name that?
Yes, her name is Michelle Wiener Davis. And she focuses on couples and infidelity. And she is just She is awesome. Yeah.
I thought one of the students in the audience really to ask some questions, really as an interested potential future psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. So I was really, really pleased with your answers and her interest in, mm-hmm. in the field. So it was great. Well, Lynn, I also want to, you mentioned a lot about how you are consuming current research, and I'm just wondering, just for our educator team, how you go about consuming current research, and how do you stay abreast of all the changes in the field?
So, there's a few things. One is that if you're a therapist, if you're in this field, you should be getting the Psychotherapy Networker, which is a great magazine that has articles from all the people who are really thinking in creative ways about the field. And often there's a lot of research referenced in those. I just pay attention to the anxiety journals. So oftentimes the way I hear about things is that there'll be some article just in the New York Times or something, and then somebody will send this to me and say, have you read about this? And then I'll look at the research. The Anxiety and Depression Association of America, the ADAA, is a great place to go and look for research. The IOCDF, which is the International OCD Foundation, oftentimes posts a lot of stuff about current research. So I just have my fingers out there and I'm just listening to what's going on. I get a lot of the stuff, a lot of the new research coming out. Other people send to me, which is great. They'll see something I haven't seen before. Reed just sent me an article the other day. So it's really just keeping my ears open and listening for what's going on and listening for questions that people are asking. Yeah.
That's outstanding. You know, you've given us so much incredible information in the last couple of days and through your reading your books. We had a wonderful book club, Reading Anxious Kids, Anxious Parents. We hope that others will link to the book in our show notes and, of course, link to your podcast. You've recorded over 190 podcasts. That's incredible. And I think I just kind of skimmed and on average about 30 to 45 minutes per. So I think you've spent, I don't know, how I can't do the math right off the top of my head, but probably a half a year of your time on it.
Yeah.
So that's incredible.
Yeah. Well, that's been pretty fun. I do it with my sister-in-law, Robin. She's married to my brother. We started it right as the pandemic was starting because we had talked about it for a while. And then when the pandemic started, she said, like, now's the time. And man, she makes stuff happen,
that's incredible.
Robin. So we just figured it out. And and so we do our weekly episodes that drop on Friday. And then we're starting to do mini episodes. So like twice a month, we're going to do additional short 15 to 20 minute episodes on some little topic or a listener question or something.
That's fantastic. And you do summarize some of your books in there. You mentioned the summer 2022 session, June mm-hmm. of 2022. Looking there. And the show is called
Fluster Clucks.
Where does that name come from?
You know where it comes from. Yeah. Yeah. it's with an X. So Fluster Clucks. And also if you look at our logo, it's a chicken, a mother chicken with little chicks. And so the whole sort of idea of like the fluster, you know, the clucking of a parent. Yeah.
Well, you've given us so much. I appreciate your time. It's been so incredibly valuable for us. I have a couple new phrases that I've learned from you. One is yizzing out. Is that what you say?
Zizzing out. Yeah.
Okay,
your prefrontal cortex zizzes out. Yeah.
And so much more. So we're going to be looking to integrate a lot of your thoughts and your teachings and into our practices as school professionals. And of course, I'm a parent and we always strive to get better for our young people. And that's the absolute least we can do and the best we can do.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to Season 3, Episode 1 of Inside LBUSD. If you have any podcast questions or suggestions, we encourage you to visit lbusd.org/podcast and let us know your thoughts. As always, please stay safe and healthy and have a wonderful week.